except monitor the wires. 6 hours into the search, there was still no sign of Nicholas Jenks. Chapter 113. Around 4, I saw Jill pushing her way through the crowd buzzing outside my office. She looked ready to kill somebody, probably me. "I'm glad you're here," I said, grabbing her. "Trust me, please, Jill." "Cindy's downstairs," she said. "Let's go talk." We sneaked out and were able to find Cindy amid a throng of reporters clawing at anyone who came down from the third floor. We called Claire, and in 5 minutes we were sitting around a table at a coffee shop just down the block. Jenks's escape had thrown all of my speculations into disarray. "You still believe he's innocent?" Jill pressed the issue immediately. "That depends on where he turns up next." I informed them that I had stationed a couple of men around the homes of Greg Marks and Joanna Wade. "Even now?" Jill shook her head and looked close to blowing. "Innocent men don't run from police custody, Lindsay." "Innocent people might," I said, "if they don't believe the justice system is being just." Claire looked around with a nervous swallow. "Ladies, it strikes me we're entering into very sensitive territory here, all right? We've got a manhunt trying to locate Jenks. He could be shot on sight. And at the same time, we're talking about trying to firm up a case against someone else. If this comes out, heads will roll. I'm looking at some of those pretty heads right now."
"If you really believe this, Lindsay, you need to take it to someone," Jill lectured me. "Roth, Mercer."
"Mercer's away, and right now everybody's focused on locating Jenks. Anyway, who the hell would believe this? As you say, all I have is a bunch of hypotheticals."
"Have you told Raleigh?" asked Claire. I nodded. "What does he think?"
"Right now he can't get past the hair. Jenks's escape didn't help my case."
"I knew there was something I liked about that guy," Jill finally smiled thinly. I looked at Claire for support. "It's hard to argue your side of things, Lindsay," she said with a sigh. "That said, your instincts are usually good."
"So then, bust in on Joanna, like Lindsay proposed," said Cindy.
The more I was around her, the more I loved her. Things had suddenly gotten very sticky in the way of accountability. I turned to Claire. "Is there anything we might have missed that could implicate Joanna?" She shook her head.
"We've been through all that. All the evidence points the finger directly at Nicholas Jenks."
"Claire, I'm talking about something that was there, right in front of us, that we just didn't see."
"I want to be with you on this, Lindsay," Claire said, "but we've been through it. Everything."
"There's gotta be something. Something that could tell us if the killer is male or female. If Joanna did it, she's no different from any killer I've tracked down. She left something. We just haven't seen it. Jenks did, or someone did for him, and we found him. And we ought to be out looking for him now," urged Jill, "before we end up with couple number 4.
I felt alone, but I just couldn't surrender. It wouldn't be right.
"Please," I begged Claire, "go through everything one more time. I think we've got the wrong man."
Chapter 114. In the light of the makeup mirror, the killer sat transfixed by soft blue eyes that were about to become gray. The first thing was to smear her hair until all the blonde had been dyed away, then brush it back smooth, 100 times, until it had lost its luster and shine. "You forced me into this," she said to the changing face. "Forced me to come out one more time. I should have expected as much. You love games, don't you, Nick?" With a cotton swab, she applied the base, a clear, sticky balm with a glue-like smell. She dabbed it over her temples, down the curve of her chin, in the soft space between her upper lip and her nose. Then, with a tweezer, she matted on the hair, tufts of reddish-brown. The face was almost complete, but the eyes, anyone could see they were still hers. She slipped out a pair of tinted contacts from the case, moistening them, stretching her lids to insert each one. She blinked, well satisfied with the result. The familiarity was gone. The change was complete. Her eyes now reflected a steely, lifeless gray. Nicholas's color. She was him. Chapter 115. Claire's call woke me out of a deep sleep.
Come down here,
her voice commanded. I blinked groggily at the clock. It was 5:10.
Come down where? I moaned. I'm at the damn office, in the damn lab. The guard at the front counter will let you in. Come right now.
I heard the urgency in her voice, and it took only seconds for me to come to my senses. You're at the lab? Since 2:30, sleepyhead. It's about Nicholas Jenks. I think I found something, and Lindsay, it is a mind-blower. At that hour, it didn't take me more than 10 minutes to get to the morgue. I parked in the circular area outside the coroner's entrance, reserved for official vehicles. I rushed in, my hair uncombed, dressed in a sweatshirt and jeans. The guard buzzed me in and let me through. He was expecting me. Claire met me at the entrance to the lab.
Okay, I said my expectations are high.
She didn't answer, only pressed me up against the door of the lab, without a word of greeting or explanation.
We're back at the Hyatt, she started in. Murder number one. David Brandt is about to open the door.
Pretend you're the groom, she said, placing her hand on my shoulder and gently easing me into place,
and I'll be the killer. I surprise you as you open the door, and stab. Right-handed. Not that it makes any difference now.
She thrust her fist into the space under my left breast.
So you fall, and that's where we find you, later, at the scene.
I nodded, letting her know that I was following along so far.
So what do we find around you? She asked, wide-eyed.
I made a mental picture of the scene. Champagne bottle, tuxedo jacket.
True, but that's not where I'm headed.
Blood. A lot of blood.
Closer.
Remember, he died of a cardiac electromechanical collapse. We simply assumed he was scared to death. I stood up, gazed down at the floor. Then suddenly I saw it, as if I were there with the body. Urine.
Right! Exclaimed Claire.
We find a small residue of urine. On his shoes. On the floor. About 6 cubic centimeters worth that I was able to save.
It seemed logical that it belonged to the groom. Voiding is a natural response to sudden fear or death.
But I was thinking last night. There were traces of urine in Cleveland, too. And here, back at the Hyatt, I never even had it tested.
Why would I? I always assumed it was from David Brandt.
But if you were here, crumpled on the floor, and I was the killer standing above you, and the pee was here, she said, pointing to the floor around me.
Who the hell's urine would it be?
Our eyes locked in one of those shining moments of epiphany.
The killer's, I said.
Claire smiled at her bright student.
The annals of forensic medicine are rich with examples of murderers getting off when they kill. So peeing isn't so far-fetched.
Your nerves would be on end. And good old compulsive me, obsessive down to the last detail, refrigerates it in a vial, never knowing what for. And the thing that makes this all come together is, urine can be tested.
Tested? For what?
For sex, Lindsay. Urine can reveal sex.
Jesus, Claire!
I was stunned. She took me into the lab to a counter with 2 microscopes, some chemicals in bottles, and a device I recognized from college chemistry classes as a centrifuge.
There aren't any flashing gender signs in urine, but there are things to look for. First, I took a sample and spun it down in the centrifuge with this KOH stain, which is something we can use to isolate impurities in blood cultures.
She motioned for me to look in the first scope. See? These tiny, filament-like branches with little clusters of cells like grapes.
Candida albicans.
I looked at her blankly.
Yeast cells, honey. This urine's laced with high deposits of yeast. Boys don't get them.
I started to smile, but before I could even reply, she dragged me on. Then I put the other sample under the scope and brought it up 3,000 mag.
Check this out.
I lowered myself over the scope and squinted in. "You see those dark crescent-shaped sails swimming around?" Claire asked.
"Uh-huh.
Red blood cells. Lots of them." I lifted my head from the scope and looked at her. "They wouldn't show up in a man's urine. Not to anywhere near this degree. Not unless they've got a bleeding kidney, which to my knowledge none of our principals show any signs of."
"Or," I shook my head slowly, "unless the killer was menstruating."
Chapter 116. I stared at Claire as the information settled in my mind. All along, Nicholas Jenks had been telling the truth. He hadn't been in the room when David and Melanie Brandt were killed that night, nor in Napa, probably not even near the Hall of Fame in Cleveland. I had hated Jenks so much I couldn't see past it. None of us had been able to get past the fact that we wanted him to be guilty. All the evidence, the hair, the jacket, the champagne, had been an incredible deception. Jenks was a master of the surprise ending, but someone had set the master up. I put my arms around Claire and hugged her.
"You're the best!"
"You're damn right I am. I don't know what it proves," she answered, patting my back, "but the person standing over that poor boy at the murder scene was a woman. And I'm just as sure that she stabbed David Brandt to death with her right hand." My mind was spinning. Jenks was loose, hundreds of cops on the chase, and he was innocent.
"So?"
Claire looked at me and smiled. "It's the second best news I've heard lately," I said.
"Second best?"
I took her hand. I told Claire what Medved had shared with me. We hugged again. We even did a little victory dance. Then both of us got back to work. Chapter 117. Upstairs at my desk, I radioed Jacoby. Poor guy, he was still sitting outside Joanna Wade's home at the corner of Filbert and Hyde. "You all right, Warren?"
"Nothing that a shower and a couple of hours of sleep wouldn't improve."
"Tell me what's going on."
"What's going on?"
Jacoby recited as if he were resentfully going over his log.
4:15 yesterday afternoon, Target comes out, struts down the block to Gold's Gym. 6:10, Target reemerges, proceeds down block to Pasqua Coffee, comes out with plastic bag. I suspect it's almond roast. Goes into the Contempo Casuals boutique, comes out empty. I gotta figure the new fall stuff hasn't arrived yet, Boxer. She makes her way home. Lights go on the third floor. Is it chicken I smell? I don't know. I'm so fucking hungry I might be dreaming. Lights go on about 10:25. Since then, she's been doing what I'd like to be doing. Why you got me out here like a rookie, Lindsay?
Because Nicholas Jenks is going to try to find his ex-wife. He believes she's setting him up. I think he knows that Joanna is the murderer.
You trying to cheer me up, Boxer? Bring meaning into my life?
Maybe. And how's this? I think she is, too. I want to know immediately if you spot Jenks. Chris Raleigh came in about 8, tossing a surprised look at my bleary eyes and disheveled appearance.
You should try a brush in the morning.
Claire called me at 5:10. I was in the morgue at 5:30. He looked at me funny.
What the hell for?
It's a little hard to explain. I want you to meet some friends of mine.
Friends? At 8 in the morning?
Uh-huh. My girlfriends. He looked completely confused.
What am I not following here?
Chris, I seized his arm, I think we broke the case. Chapter 118. An hour later, I got everyone together on the Jenks case, hopefully for the last time. There had been a few alleged sightings of Nicholas Jenks, in Tiburon down by the marina, and south of Market, huddled around a gathering of homeless men. Both of them proved false. He had eluded us, and the longer he remained free, the greater the speculation. We got together in a vacant interrogation room that sex crimes sometimes used. Claire smuggled Cindy up from the lobby, then we rang down Jill.
"I see we've loosened the requirements," Jill commented when she came in and saw Chris. Raleigh looked surprised, too. "Don't mind me, I'm just the token male.
You remember Claire and Jill Bernhardt from the district attorney's office, I said. Cindy, you may recall from Napa. The team. Slowly, Chris looked from one face to another until he settled on me.
You've been working on this independently of the task force?
Don't ask, said Jill, plunking herself down in a wooden chair. Just listen. In the cramped, narrow room, all eyes turned to me. I looked at Claire. You want to begin?
She nodded, scanned the group as if she were presenting at a medical conference. On Lindsay's urging, I spent all last night going through the three case files. I was looking for anything that would implicate Joanna. At first, nothing, other than coming to the same conclusion I had before, that from the angle of the first victim's wounds, the killer was right-handed. Jenks is left-handed. But it was clear that it wouldn't stick. Then, something struck me that I had never noticed before. At both the first and third crime scenes, there were traces of urine. Individually, I guess neither the medical examiner in Cleveland nor I ever thought much of it. But as I thought through the crime scenes in my head, the locations of these deposits didn't make any sense. Early this morning, very early, I rushed down here and performed some tests.
There was barely a breath in the room.
The urine we found at the Grand Hyatt demonstrated large deposits of yeast, as well as atypically large counts of red blood cells. Red blood cells in that amount appear in the urine during menstruation. Coupled with the yeast, there's no doubt in my mind that the urine was a woman's. A woman killed David Brandt, and I have no doubt we'll find a woman was in the stall in Cleveland, too.
Jill blinked, dumbfounded. Cindy's bright red lips parted in an incredulous half-smile.
Raleigh just shook his head.
Jenks didn't do it, I said. Joanna must have. He abused her. Then he dumped her for his new wife, Chessie, just as he was about to strike it rich. Joanna tried to sue him twice unsuccessfully, ended up with a settlement many times smaller than she would have gotten a year later. She watched him gain celebrity and wealth and a new, seemingly happy life.
Chris looked amazed. You really believe a woman could physically pull this off? The first victims were stabbed. The second were dragged 20-30 yards to where they were dumped.
You haven't seen her, I replied. She knew how to set Jenks up. She knew his tastes, his investments, and had access to his possessions. She even worked at Saks.
Cindy chipped in.
She was one of the few people who would have been aware of always a bridesmaid.
I nodded toward Jill. She had the means, the motive, and I'm damned sure she had the desire. A really heavy silence filled the room. So, how do you want to play this? Chris finally said. Half the force is looking for Jenks.
I want to inform Mercer. Try to get Jenks brought in without someone killing him. Then I want to go ahead and pierce Joanna's cover. Phone calls, credit cards. If she was in Cleveland, something will tie her there. I think you'd agree now, I said to Jill, we have enough to authorize a search.
Jill nodded, at first hesitantly, then with more resolve.
It's just impossible to believe that after all this, we now have to defend that bastard. Suddenly, there was a loud rap on the glass window of the door.
John Carasty, an inspector on the task force, broke in on us. It's Jenks. He's just been sighted. He's up in Pacific Heights.
Chapter 119. Raleigh and I leaped up, almost as one, racing back to the command center. It appeared Jenks had been seen in the lobby of a small hotel called the El Drisco. A bellboy spotted him. Free of his cuffs. Now he was on the streets, somewhere up in Pacific Heights.
Why there?
My mind ratcheted through the possibilities. Then it became clear. Greg Marks lived up there. I radioed Paul Chin, who was still sitting surveillance on the agent's brownstone. Paul, be on the alert, I told him. Jenks may be headed your way. He was seen in Pacific Heights. There was a beep on my cell phone. It was Jacoby. Everything was happening at once.
Boxer, there's an all-available units on Jenks up in the Heights about a mile from here. I'm headed up there.
"Warren, don't leave!" I shouted into the receiver. I still believed Joanna was the murderer. I couldn't leave her unmonitored, especially with Jinx on the loose. "Stay at your post!"
"This takes precedence," Jacoby argued. "Besides, nothing's happening here. I'll call a radio car to relieve."
"Jacoby!" I shouted. But he had already signed off and was on his way to the Heights. I turned to Chris. "Warren's left Joanna's."
Suddenly Karen, our civilian clerical, shouted for me. "Lindsay, call for you on one!"
"We're headed out," I hollered back to her.
I had strapped on my gun, grabbed the keys to my car. "Who is it?"
"Says you'd want to talk to him about the Jenks case," Karen said. "Says his name is Philip Campbell."
Chapter 120. I froze, fixed on Raleigh, and lunged back toward my desk. I signaled Karen to put it through. At the same time, I hissed under my breath to Raleigh, "Start a trace." I waited in a trance. Seconds could mean the difference. The breath was tightening in my chest. Then I picked up.
"You know who this is," Nicholas Jenks's arrogant voice declared.
"I know who it is. Where are you?"
"Not a chance, Inspector. I only called to let you know, whatever happens, I didn't kill any of them. I'm not a murderer."
"I know that," I told him.
He seemed surprised.
"You know?"
I couldn't let Jenks know who it was, not with him on the loose. "I promise we can prove it wasn't you. Tell me where you are."
"Hey, guess what? I don't believe you," Jenks declared. "Besides, it's too late. I told you I'd take this into my own hands. I'm going to solve these murders for you."
Jenks could hang up any moment and we'd lose him. This was my only chance.
"Jenks, I'll meet you anywhere you want."
"Why would I want to meet you? I've seen enough of you to last a lifetime."
"Because I know who did it," I told him.
What he said next jolted me.
"So do I."
And then he hung up. Chapter 121. Sixth, Market, Taylor. The streets shot by, the top hat on the roof of Chris Raleigh's car flashing wildly. Ellis, Larkin. We shot up Larkin, climbing through the lights, then rocked over the bumps as we careened over Knob Hill. In a matter of minutes, we arrived in Russian Hill. Joanna lived on the top floor of a townhouse on the corner of Filbert and Hyde. We were no longer waiting to flush her out. Jenks was loose. He had probably homed in on her. Now it was a matter of preventing more killing. We slowed, cut the lights as we wove through the quiet, hilly streets. The house had been unguarded for maybe 15 minutes. I didn't know if Joanna was up there, or where the hell Jenks was. Chris pulled to the curb. We checked our guns and decided how to proceed. Then I saw a sight that tore the breath from my lungs. Chris saw it, too.
"Christ, he's here!"
From a narrow alley 2 houses away, a man in a beard and baggy sport coat emerged. He looked both ways as he hit the street. Then he made his way down the block.
"It was Jenks!"
Raleigh pulled out his gun and reached for the door. I looked closer in disbelief, grabbed onto him.
"Wait! Look again, Chris!"
We both gaped in amazement. He had the same look, the short reddish-gray hair, the same unmistakable beard.
But it wasn't Jenks!
The figure was thinner, fairer. The hair was slicked back, hiding a longer length, not cut short. I could see that much.
It was a woman.
"That's Joanna," I said.
"Where's Jenks?" Chris grunted. "This just keeps getting creepier."
We watched the figure slink down the block as a frenzy of possibilities ran through my mind.
This was creepy.
"I'll follow her," said Chris. "You go upstairs. Make sure it's her, Lindsay. I'll radio for support. Go on, Lindsay, go."
The next moment I was out of the car, crossing the street toward Joanna's apartment. Chris eased the Taurus down the block. I pushed random buttons until a woman's angry voice replied. I identified myself, and a gray-haired woman emerged from the apartment next to the front door. She announced that she was the landlady. I badged her, got her to locate a key pronto. Then I told her to get back in her apartment. I had my gun out, took off the safety. A film of hot sweat was building up on my face and neck. I reached Joanna's apartment on the 3rd floor. My heart was pounding. "Careful, Lindsay," a voice inside me said. Then came a cautioning chill. Could Nicholas Jenks be here? I had certainly entered enough hostile environments during my police career. None worse than this. I inserted the key, turned, and when the lock caught, pushed the door with my foot. It swung open, revealing the bright, stylishly decorated apartment of Joanna Wade.
"Anyone here?" I shouted.
No one answered. There was no one in the living room. Same for the dining room, kitchen, a coffee mug in the sink, the Chronicle out and folded to the style section. No sign that I was in the home of a psycho. That bothered me. I moved on. Magazines, Food and Wine, San Francisco, on the coffee table, a few yoga posture books. In the bedroom, the bed unmade. The entire place had a relaxed, unforbidding feel. Joanna Wade lived like any ordinary woman. She read, had coffee in her kitchen, taught exercise, paid her bills. Killers were preoccupied with their victims. This didn't make sense. I turned into the master bath.
Oh, damn it!
The case had made a last, irrevocable turn. On the floor, in her workout tights, was Joanna Wade. She was leaned against the tub, looking at me, but not really. Actually, she was still looking at her killer. Her eyes were wide and terrified. He had used a knife. Jenks? If not him, then who?
Oh, Christ, I gasped.
My head was spinning, and it hurt. I hurried over to her, but there was nothing I could do. Everything had twisted again. I knelt over the dead woman as a final shuddering thought filled my mind. If it wasn't Joanna, who was Chris following? Chapter 122. Within minutes, two blue and whites screeched to a stop outside. I directed the patrol officers upstairs to the grisly body of Joanna, but my thoughts had turned to Chris. And whoever he was following. I had been up in the apartment for 10, maybe 12 minutes, without a word from him. I was worried. He was following a murderer, and a murderer who had just killed Joanna Wade. I ran downstairs to an open patrol car. I called in what had happened to Command Central. A riot of doubts was crashing in my mind. Could it somehow have been Jenks after all? Could Jill have been right? Was he manipulating us right from the start? Had he set everything up, even the sighting in Pacific Heights? But if it was him, why? Why, after I had told him I believed him, why would he kill her now? Was Joanna's death something I could have prevented? What in hell was going on? Where was Chris, damn it? My cell phone finally beeped. To my relief, it was Chris. Where are you? You had me scared to death. Don't do that to me. Down by the marina. The suspect's in a blue Saab. Chris, be careful. It's not Joanna. Joanna's dead. She was stabbed a bunch of times in her apartment. Dead? He repeated. I could feel the frantic question slowly sinking into his mind. Then who the hell is driving the Saab up ahead of me? Tell me where you are exactly. Bay and North Point. The suspect just pulled up to the curb. The suspect is getting out of the car. Somehow this sounded familiar. Bay and North Point? What was down there? In the tumult of blue and white screeching up in front of Joanna's building and reporting in, I raked my mind for a connection. He's heading away from the car, Lindsay. He's starting to run. Then it hit me. The photo I had picked up at Jenks's house. The beautiful and unmistakable moonlit dome. The Palace of Fine Arts. It was where he had been married. I think I know where he's going, I shouted. The Palace of Fine Arts. Chapter 123. I took off in the radio car with the siren blaring all the way to the Presidio. It took me no more than 7 minutes, with traffic wildly shifting out of my way, to speed down Lombard over to Richardson to the south tip of the Presidio. Up ahead, the golden rotunda of the Palace of Fine Arts loomed powerfully above a calm, gleaming pond. I saw Chris's blue Taurus pulled up diagonally across from the tip of the park and jackknifed the patrol car to a halt next to it. I didn't see a sign of any other cops. Why hadn't any backup arrived? What the hell was going on now? I clicked my gun off safety and made my way into the park underneath the giant rotunda. No way I was waiting. I was startled by people running toward me, away from the rotunda grounds.
"Someone's shooting!" one of them screamed. Suddenly my legs were flying. "Everyone out! I'm San Francisco police!" I screamed as I bumped through the people rushing by. "Maniac with a gun!" one of them yelled. I ran around the pond alongside a massive marble colonnade. There was no sound up ahead, no more shots. Leading with my gun, I rounded corners until I was in sight of the main rotunda. Huge Corinthian columns soared above me, capped with ornate heroic carvings. I could hear voices in the distance, a woman's mocking tone. "It's just you and me, Nick. Imagine that. Isn't it romantic?" And a man's voice, Jenks's.
"Look at you. You're pathetic. As always."
The voices echoed out of the huge dome of the main rotunda. Where was Chris? And where was our backup? Cops should have been here by now. I held my breath, straining to hear the first police siren. Every step I took, I heard my own footsteps echoing to the roof.
"What do you want?"
I heard Jenks's cry reverberating off the stone. Then the woman shouting back, "I want you to remember them. All the women you fucked." Still no sign of Chris. I was tight with worry. I decided to go around the side of a row of low arches that ran down to where the voices were coming from. I ducked around the corner of the colonnade. Then I saw Chris. He was sitting there, propped against a pillar, watching everything unfold. My first reaction was to say something like, "Chris, get down, someone will see you." It was one of those slow-motion perceptions where my eyes were faster than my mind. Then I was seized with horrible fright, nausea, and sadness. Chris wasn't watching, and he wasn't hiding. The front of his shirt was covered with blood. All my police training nearly gave way. I wanted to scream, to cry out. It took everything I had to hold it in. Two dark bloodstains were soaking through Chris's shirt. My legs were paralyzed. Somehow I forced myself over to him. I knelt down. My heart was pounding. Chris's eyes were remote, his face as gray as stone. I checked for a pulse and felt the slightest rhythm of a heartbeat. "Oh, Chris, no!" I stifled a sob. When I spoke, he looked up, eyes glimmering as he saw my face. His lips parted into a weak smile. His breath wheezed, heavy and labored. My eyes filled with tears. I applied pressure to the holes in his chest, trying to push back the blood. "Oh, Chris, hang in there. Hang in there. I'll get help." He reached for my arm. He tried to speak, but it was only a weak, guttural whisper. "Don't talk, please." I raced back to the patrol car and fumbled with the transmitter until I heard dispatch. "Officer down! Officer down!" I shouted. 406! I repeat, 406! The statewide call for alarm. "Officer shot, rotunda of the Palace of Fine Arts. Need immediate EMS and SWAT backup. Possible Nicholas Jenks sighting. Second officer on the scene inside. Repeat, 406, emergency." As soon as the dispatcher repeated the location back to me with a copy, I threw down the transmitter and headed back inside. When I got to him, Chris was still holding on to small breaths. A bubble of blood popped on his lip. "I love you, Chris," I whispered, squeezing his hand. Voices rang out ahead in the rotunda. I couldn't make them out, but it was the same man and woman. Then there was a gunshot.
"Go,"
Chris whispered.
"I'm holding on."
Our hands touched.
"I've got rear,"
he muttered with a smile. Then he pushed me away. I scurried ahead, my gun drawn, glancing back twice. Chris was watching.
Watching my back.
I ran in a low crouch all the way down the length of the row of columns closest in, clear up to the side of the main rotunda. The voices echoed, intensified. My eyes were riveted. They were straight across the basilica. Jenks, in a plain white shirt. He was holding one arm, bleeding. He'd been shot. And across from him, holding a gun and dressed in a man's clothes, Chessy Jenks. Chapter 124. She looked like a bizarre disfigurement of the beautiful woman she was. Her hair was matted and dyed gray and red. Her face still carried the marks of her disguise, a man's sideburns and flecks of a red beard.
She was holding a gun tightly, pointing it directly at him.
I have a present for you, Nick.
A present? Jenks said in desperation. What the hell are you talking about?
That's why we're here. I want to renew our vows.
Chessie took a small pouch out of her jacket and tossed it at his feet.
Go ahead. Open it.
Nicholas Jenks knelt stiffly and picked up the pouch. He opened it, the contents spilling into his palm. His eyes bulged in horror.
The 6 missing rings. Chessie, Christ, he said. You're out of your mind. What do you want me to do with these?
He held out a ring.
These will put you in the gas chamber.
No, Nick,
Chessie said, shaking her head.
I want you to swallow them. Get rid of the evidence for me.
Jenks's face twitched in apprehension.
You want me to what?
Swallow them. Each one is someone you've destroyed, someone whose beauty you've killed. They were innocent. Like me. Little girls on our wedding days. You killed us all, Nick. Me, Kathy, Joanna. So now give us something back. With this ring, I do pledge.
Jenks glared and shouted at her.
That's enough, Chessie.
I'll say when it's enough. You love games, so play the game. Play my game this time. Swallow them.
She pointed the gun.
No sense pretending I won't shoot, is there, dear?
Jenks took one of the rings, raised it to his lips. His hand was shaking badly.
That was Melanie, Nicky. He would have liked her. Athletic, a skier, a diver. Your type, huh? She fought me to the end. But you don't like us to fight, do you? You like to be in total control.
She cocked the gun and leveled it at Jenks's head. Jenks put the ring in his mouth. With a sickened expression, he forced it down his throat. Chessie was losing it. She was sobbing, trembling. I didn't think I could wait any longer.
Police!
I yelled. I stepped forward, two hands on my .38, leveling it at her. She spun at me, not even showing surprise, then back to Jenks.
He has to be punished!
It's over, I said, carefully advancing toward her. Please, Chessie, no more killing.
As if she suddenly realized what she had become, the sickening things she'd done, she looked at me.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for everything that happened. Except this.
She fired.
At Jenks.
I fired, too. At her. Chessie's slender body flew backward, hitting the wall hard and crumpling against it. Her beautiful eyes widened, and her mouth sagged open. I looked, and saw that she'd missed Jenks. He was staring at her in disbelief. He didn't think she could do it, didn't think she hated him that much. He still believed he controlled Chessie, and probably that she loved him. I hurried to her, but it was too late. Her eyes were already glazed, and the blood was streaming from her chest. I held her head and thought that she was so beautiful. Like Melanie. Rebecca, Kathy, and now she was dead, too. Nicholas Jenks turned toward me with a gasp of relief.
I told you I was innocent.
I looked at him in disgust. 8 people were dead, the brides and grooms, Joanna, now his own wife.
I told you I was innocent? Is that what he thought?
I swung, my fist catching him square in the teeth. I felt something shatter as Jenks dropped to his knees.
So much for innocence, Jenks!
Chapter 125. I was running, and I realized that I no longer knew exactly what I was doing, where I was. Somehow my instincts brought me back to where Chris had been shot. He was still up against the pillar in the same position. He looked as if he'd been waiting for me to return. I rushed up to him, knelt down as close as I could get. I could see police and the EMS medical crew finally arriving.
What took them so long? What happened?
Chris whispered. I could barely hear him.
I got her, Chris. Chessie Jenks was the killer.
He managed to nod his head.
That's my girl, he whispered.
Then Chris smiled faintly, and he died on me. I never would have imagined or dreamed that Chris would be the first to die. That was the most terrible and dreadful shock. I was the sick one, the one whom death had brushed against. I put my head down close to his chest. There was no movement, no breath, just a terrifying stillness. Everything seemed so unreal. Then the medics were working on Chris, doing heroic, useless things, and I just sat there, holding his hand. I felt hollowed out and empty and incredibly sad. I was sobbing, but I had something to say to him. I had to tell Chris one last thing.
Medved told me, Chris, I'm going to be okay.
Chapter 126. I couldn't go near my office at the hall. I was given a 1 week leave. I figured I'd take another of my own time on top of that. I sat around, watched some videos of old movies, went for my treatments, took a jog or two down by the marina. I even cooked and sat out on the terrace overlooking the bay, just as I had with Chris that first night. On one of those nights, I got really drunk and started playing with my gun. It was Sweet Martha who talked me off the ledge. That, and the fact that if I killed myself, I would be betraying Chris's memory. I couldn't do that. Also, the girls would never have forgiven me, right? I felt a hole tear at my heart, larger and more painful than anything I had ever felt, even with Negley's. I felt a void of connection, of commitment. Claire called me 3 times a day, but I just couldn't speak for very long, not even to her. It wasn't you, Lindsay. There was nothing you could have done, she consoled.
I kind of know that, I replied, but I just couldn't convince myself it was true.
Mostly I tried to persuade myself I still felt a sense of purpose. The bride and groom murders were solved. Nicholas Jenks was shamelessly milking his celebrity status on Dateline in 2020. My Negleys seemed to be in remission. Chris was gone. I tried to think of what I would do next. Nothing very appealing came to mind. Then I remembered what I had told Claire when my fears of Negley's were the strongest. Nailing this guy was the one clear thing that gave me the strength to go on. It wasn't just about right or wrong. It wasn't about guilt or innocence. It was about what I was good at and what I loved to do. 4 days after the shooting, I went to Chris's funeral. It was in a Catholic church out in Hayward, where he was from. I took my place in the ranks with Roth and Jacoby, with Chief Mercer, who was dressed in blues. But my heart was aching so bad. I wanted to be up near Chris. I wanted to be next to him. I watched his ex-wife and his 2 boys struggling to keep it together. I was thinking about how very close I had come to their lives, and they didn't know it. Hero cop, they were eulogizing him. He was a marketing guy, I thought, smiling. And then I started to cry. Of all people, I felt Jacoby grasp my hand. And of all the improbable things, I found myself holding his back.
Go ahead, he seemed to be saying. Go ahead and weep.
Afterward, at the graveside, I went up to Chris's ex-wife, Marion. I wanted to meet you, I said. I was with him when he died. She looked at me with the fragile courage only another woman could understand. I know who you are, she said with a compassionate smile. You are pretty. Chris told me you were pretty and smart. I smiled and took her hand. We both squeezed hard.
He also said you were very brave.
I felt my eyes well up. Then she took my arm and said the one thing that I wanted most to hear.
Why don't you stand with us, Lindsay?
The department gave Chris a hero's burial. Sad, mournful bagpipers opened the ceremony, row after row of cops in dress blues, a 21-gun salute. When it was over, I found myself walking back to the car, wondering what in God's name I was going to do next. At the cemetery gates, I spotted Cindy and Jill and Claire. They were waiting there for me. I didn't move. I stood there, my legs trembling badly. They could see that if they didn't make the first move, I could break down.
"Why don't you ride back with us?" Claire said.
My voice cracked. I could barely utter the words.
"It was supposed to be me, not him," I said to them.
Then one by one, they all hugged me. I put my arms around all of them and melted into their embrace as deeply as I could. All four of us were crying.
"Don't ever leave me, guys."
"Leave?" Jill said with wide eyes.
"None of us," promised Cindy. "We're a team, remember? We will always be together."
Claire took hold of my arm.
"We love you, sweetie," she whispered.
The four of us walked arm in arm out of the cemetery. A cooling breeze was blowing in our faces, drying our tears. At 6 o'clock that night, I was back inside the halls of the Hall of Justice. There was something important I had to do. In the lobby, almost the first thing you see, there's a large marble plaque. On it are 93 names, the names and dates of 91 men and 2 women who wore the uniform of the SFPD and died in the line of duty. A mason is working on the plaque. It's an unwritten rule on the force, you never count them. But tonight, I did. 93. Starting with James S. Kuntz on October 5, 1878, when the SFPD was first formed. Tomorrow, there will be one more. Christopher John Raleigh. The mayor will be there. Mercer, too. The reporters who cover the city beat. Marion and the boys. They will memorialize him as a hero cop. I will be there, too. But tonight, I don't want speeches or ceremonies. Tonight, I want it to be just him and me. The mason finishes up the engraving of his name. I wait while he sands the marble, vacuums away the last particle of dust. Then I walk up and run my hand over the smooth marble, over his name. Christopher John Raleigh. The mason looks at me. He can see the pain welling in my eyes.
"You knew him, huh?"
I nod, and from somewhere deep in my heart, a smile comes forth.
"I knew him."
"Partner," I say. Epilogue. Coup de Grâce. Chapter 127. I have come to learn that murder investigations always have loose ends and questions that cry out to be answered. Always. But not this time. I was home one night about a month after we buried Chris. I had finished dinner for one, fed and walked her sweetness, when there was a knock on the door, a single authoritative rap. I hadn't buzzed anyone up from downstairs, so I went and looked through the peephole before I opened up. I couldn't believe my eyes. It was Nicholas Jenks. He had on a blue blazer over a white shirt and dark gray slacks. He looked as arrogant and obnoxious as ever.
"Aren't you going to let me in?"
he asked, then smiled as if to say, "Of course you are. You can't resist, can you?" "No, actually I'm not," I told him. I walked away from the door. "Get lost, asshole." Jenks knocked again, and I stopped walking. "We have nothing to talk about," I called loudly enough for him to hear.
"Oh, but we do," Jenks called back. "You blew it, Inspector. I'm here to tell you how."
I froze, I could feel my eyes blazing, heat burning the back of my neck. I walked back to the door, paused, then opened it, my heart beating fast.
You blew it.
He was smiling, or maybe laughing at me.
I'm celebrating, he said. I'm a happy fella. Guess how come?
Don't tell me, because you're a bachelor again.
Well, there's that. But I also just sold North American rights to my latest book. $8 million. Then the movie's paid for. This one's non-fiction, Lindsay. Guess the subject. Go ahead, take a stab.
I wanted desperately to punch Jenks out again. And I'm the one you have to share your news with. How goddamn sad for you. Jenks continued to grin.
Actually, I came here to share something else. You are the only one I want to share this with. Do I have your attention yet, Lindsay? You blew it. Big time, babe.
He was so creepy and inappropriate that he was scaring me. I didn't want him to see it. What did he mean, I blew it? I'd offer you a drink, but I hate your guts, I smirked. He threw up his hands, imitated my smirk.
You know, I feel exactly the same thing toward you. That's why I wanted to tell you this, Lindsay. Only you.
He lowered his voice to a whisper.
Chessie did what I told her to do.
Right up until the very end. The murders? We were playing a terrible, wonderful game. Tragic husband and wife kill happy, innocent husbands and wives. We were living out the plot of a novel. My novel.
You blew it, Lindsay. I got away clean. I'm free. I'm so free. And now I'm richer than ever.
He stared at me. Then he started to laugh. It was probably the most sickening sound I'd heard in my life.
It's true. Chessie would do anything I wanted her to do. All of them would. That's why I picked them. I used to play a game where they barked like dogs. They loved it. Wanna play, Lindsay? Ruff, ruff!
I glared at him. Don't you feel kind of inadequate, playing your father's old games? Joanna told me.
I took things way past anything my father ever imagined. I've done it all, Inspector, and I got away with it. I planned every murder. Doesn't that make your fucking skin crawl? Doesn't it make you feel inadequate?
Suddenly, Jenks was putting on plastic gloves he took out of his jacket pockets. What the hell?
This is perfect, too, he said. I'm not here, Lindsay. I'm with this sweet little liar of a bitch in Tahoe. I have an alibi bought and paid for. Perfect crimes, Lindsay. My specialty.
As I turned to run, Jenks took out a knife.
I want to feel this going inside you, Lindsay. Deep, the coup de grace.
Help! I screamed. But then he hit me hard. I was shocked at how fast he moved and how powerful he was. I slammed into a living room wall and almost went out. Martha instinctively went after him. I'd never seen her bare her teeth before. He lashed out and cut her shoulder. Martha fell over, whining horribly.
Stay away, Martha!
I screamed at her. Jenks picked me up and threw me into my bedroom. He shut the door.
There was supposed to be another bride and groom murder while I was in jail. New evidence was going to slowly reveal itself. It would become clear that I was innocent, framed. Then I'd write the book. But Chessie turned around and double-crossed me. I never respected her more, Lindsay. I almost loved her for it. She showed some goddamn guts for once.
I crawled away from Jenks, but he could see there was nowhere for me to go in the bedroom. I thought I might have a broken rib.
You'll have to kill me first,
I told him in a hoarse whisper.
Okay, he grinned. Glad to oblige. My pleasure.
I crawled hand over hand toward my bed, the side facing a window on the bay. It was hard to breathe. Jenks came after me.
Stop, Jenks,
I yelled at the top of my voice. Stop right there, Jenks!
He didn't stop. Why should he? He slashed back and forth with the knife.
Christ, he was enjoying this. He was laughing. Another perfect murder.
I reached under the bed to where I'd fastened a holster and revolver, my home security system. I didn't have time to aim, but I didn't have to. Nicholas Jenks was stunned, the knife poised over his left shoulder. I fired 3 times. Jenks screamed, his gray eyes bulged in disbelief. Then he collapsed dead on top of me.
Burn in hell, I whispered.
I called Claire first, the medical examiner. Then Cindy, the best crime reporter in San Francisco. Then Jill, my lawyer. The girls came running.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks production of First to Die, written by James Patterson and read by Suzanne Torin. First to Die is also available in hardcover from Little Brown and Company.
This book is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.